this week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
You can jail a revolutionary, but you cannot jail the revolution. You can run a freedom fighter around the country, but you cannot run freedom fighting around the country.
Activists call on San Francisco District Attorney Brooke Jenkins to drop the charges against 26 pro-Palestinian protesters who blocked the Golden Gate Bridge in April.
That's the scary thing, and that's what's happening now. Many of the things that have been protecting rights are being flipped, are being overturned, or they're being dismantled so that those in power can become what? Even more powerful and even more wealthy.
Attorney Adante Poynter of Lawyers for the People breaks down the recent controversial rulings released by the Supreme Court.
What the Olympics are is a for-profit propelling industry or commodity for a lot of different interests.
The recently completed Olympics was claimed to be a financial success, but behind the Olympics were massive profiteering and ideological campaigns by the major Western imperialist countries. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Paulina Vasilyev. On April 15th, there was an International Day of Action to stop the genocide in Gaza. In San Francisco, District Attorney Brooke Jenkins has filed criminal charges, including felonies, against 26 activists who blocked the Golden Gate Bridge for 2 hours. Lucia, a Palestinian-American healthcare worker, spoke on August 12th at a solidarity rally at the Highway Patrol, where those charged were turning themselves in.
My name is Lucia. I'm a healthcare worker. I work as a doula. When I first started training as a doula, I did it for free. I served the BIPOC community right here in San Francisco because I believe that everyone deserves access to competent care and to support in the most vulnerable time of their life. Later, when I started making $20 an hour for a grassroots organization, I had to write down exactly how I spent every single minute of every hour so that we could get our grant money. Brooke Jenkins once also served her community for free as a volunteer for a campaign run by an organization called Neighbors for a Better San Francisco. If you're not familiar with them, they are a self-identified social welfare nonprofit founded by two realtor lobbyists, backed by Republican mega donors, and headed by an alleged rapist. Shame. Their main objectives have been to defeat progressive candidates and consolidate power. In November, remember that they'll be supporting Prop E, which allows for looser rules around police chases, surveillance, and oversight of police use of force, which is in line with what our mayor, London Breed, wants. Boo! Now you might be asking, what was the cause that moved Crook Jenkins to work for free? It was the recall for her now predecessor, Chesa Boudin. Shame. Neighbors contributed over $4.7 million to this recall. $153,000 of that was used to pay Brooke, this unpaid volunteer. Now, if you're familiar with the law, which clearly Brooke is not, that's a violation of ethics and the law. Now, when the complaint came to light, regulators were urged to compel Jenkins and Neighbors for a Better San Francisco to provide the records, including the timesheets that people like me have to fill out in our working class jobs, to confirm whether she had actually performed $153 worth of labor. She did not provide that. In a surprise to absolutely no one, as soon as she was appointed, all the effort efforts by Chesa Boudin at criminal justice reform were reversed. She has dismissed every charge against cops that Chesa had instated. She's decreased the rate of diversions, and she has induced the mass exodus of dozens of staffers from her office. Shame. And yet I want to tell you something that Brooke once said, which is, violence and repeat offenders will no longer be allowed to victimize our city without consequence. So I want to talk to you all about violence. Violence is $13.5 million from California's working class taxes, because the rich don't pay, being stolen from us to rape, dismember, bomb, and displace my people in Palestine. Shame! Line. Violence is the Supreme Court gutting the Voting Rights Act in 2013 and the Senate blocking a bill to restore those rights by a two-vote margin in 2022. Is that democracy? Yeah. Violence is California state lawmakers introducing two voter restriction bills in 2020 and 2023. During a pandemic, they knew what was coming and they restricted our voting rights. It is Californians needing to work 109-hour weeks to afford a two-bedroom house on minimum wage. Violence is grants pass. Violence is street sweeps, stealing from our unhoused community members and leaving them with nowhere to go. Violence is a $1.1 trillion military budget. Violence is the fact that what California taxpayers pay for deportations and border control alone could provide health insurance for 2 million children or 500,000 public housing units. This is not democracy. Now, violence is also LAPD eating Chick-fil-A while our student comrades at UCLA were being brutalized by Zionists. Speaking of Dr. King, he once said, "The bombs dropped in Vietnam explode at home." We are called upon to raise certain basic questions about the whole society. We must recognize that we can't solve our problem now until there is a radical redistribution of economic and political power. Now, when the Golden Gate 26 were arrested, I watched those interviews on the TV and I saw people in their cars say, "This is not the way to get people to support your cause." And what I have to tell them is, if 10 months of beheaded children, if the rape to death of Palestinian men, if the ecocide of our olive groves, of our strawberry fields, of the displacement of our families and our ancestral homes has not been enough to move you to our cause, then we can't drag you to your liberation. We are all here because we stand with our comrades, not because they were doing it to change minds, but because they were here to disrupt the means of production by any means necessary. One is what the revolutionary Fred Hampton said, because I need us all right now, as we come up on the 1 year anniversary of this genocide, we need to step into our own leadership, our own organizing. Y'all, it is time. Even if all you do is call Crook Jenkins and tell her to drop these charges, that is something. Everything matters, and not one single thing is enough. It takes all of us. The revolutionary Fred Hampton said, "We learn by observation and participation." The Panthers learned one thing. When there is a fire, you gather around the fire. People saw what was going on and they had a chance to participate in it. It is up to us to teach our own people about the power structures. down the road of revolution. Because you can jail a revolutionary, but you cannot jail the revolution. You can run a freedom fighter around the country, but you cannot run freedom fighting around the country. You can murder a liberator, you can murder Palestinians, but you cannot murder liberation.
That was Palestinian-American healthcare activist Lucia, who talked about the San Francisco District Attorney Brooke Jenkins and the criminal charges she brought against those who protested against the genocide in Gaza.
Genocide, it's a genocide. Genocide, it's a genocide.
Yo, all they do is lie about Palestine. Dehumanize lives, justify war crimes. 75 years of occupation, now it's extermination. Ooh, we live on our news feeds. A Holocaust in real time, and some are talking both sides. Opinions left and right, while children are left to die from war to rockets. It's a racket that stabilized the debt market. Ask a million dead Iraqis. Pregúntale a los palestinos, a los sirios. A los hijos de los desaparecidos. Ask the mother of the child bombed to smithereens. Ask the man who lost his fam to the military machine. Reading back, backed up by the arms industry. Best believe, blow back or go beyond the Middle East. Hit the streets of America, ka, ka, ka. Sunsets on the empire, ojalá, yeah.
Genocide, it's a genocide. Genocide, it's a genocide. Genocide, it's a genocide. Genocide, it's a genocide.
This is a reminder. This is not a conflict. 75 years, the whole world watching. If you took my land, I might have to push you off it. The military complex, making profits. Apartheid, settler colonialism. Millions of people in an open-air prison. Gotta be real, we can't call it a war. When the scales are unequal, I'm on the side of the poor. Who got no water, no medical supplies, no electricity, I'm getting sick of all the lies. Corporate media, Western propaganda, in Ferguson I learned to organize con la ganga. Rest in power to the comrade Bass. Some Palestinians gave us glasses to deal with tear gases. Shots to the eyes, they shot hundreds in Chile. Trained by IDF to control my village. They monopolize the violence, monopolize the narrative. Free Palestina and the moment is imperative. Shots to my relatives, gotta sing my song. Cause they be killing us just for way too long.
Genocide, it's a genocide. Genocide, it's a genocide. Genocide, it's a genocide, whatever. Genocide, it's a genocide.
Palestina libre. Viva, viva Palestina.
That was Rebel Diaz, 1-800-GENOCIDE. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Paulina Vasilyev. Next, lawyer Adante Poynter of Lawyers for the People breaks down the recent controversial rulings released by the Supreme Court. He spoke to J.R. Val Ray of Block Report Radio about Chevron deference, the court criminalizing homelessness, the legalization of political bribery, and the absolute power of the President of the United States.
One of the things that the Supreme Court dealt with is the Chevron deference. What is Chevron deference? How will this new ruling affect the people?
Yeah, so the Chevron ruling that the Supreme Court just came down with in the Chevron case in particular is a case that the Supreme Court ruled on recently where they essentially said that the federal judges, so any judge really, does not have to give deference to the federal agencies that regulate specific types of conduct or things in our country. Example, the EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, they are supposed to be the federal government's experts on how to protect our environment, how to regulate what type of chemicals are going in the air, going to our food, go into the ground, and go into our water. And so the Supreme Court essentially overturned decades of law and rulings, which essentially said that we would allow the experts to decide how certain things should be regulated versus putting it in a judge's hands that does not have the expertise. Well, our conservative Supreme Court overturned that type of thinking and instead said there's nothing that shows why a judge should defer to experts, and that a judge to make these decisions. And what that means for people out there listening is that when it comes to something like the Food and Drug Administration, which regulates what type of chemicals can go into our food in particular, a judge could say, you know what? Forget what this expert said around chemical carcinogens being in Ho-Hos or Twinkies. I think that that's not enough to cause somebody harm. And so just based upon my understanding of science, which clearly they don't have the same level of science as a scientist, I'm going to say that it's okay to put those chemicals in the food, or it's okay to put these type of pollutants in water and things like that. So it really, really, really has just created a whole lot of chaos, in my opinion, because as opposed to federal agencies who are paid and who are studying specific things and are supposed to be experts and they study these things and review these things, as opposed to them being the people who set guidelines, a judge could just on their own say, you know what, I'm going to ignore all of that. And instead, I think it should be like this. And so it's taking control out of the hands of experts and putting it in control of judges, which, interestingly enough, is something that most conservative judges used to argue and fight against all the time, which is what they call activist judges. That was like a bad term when they thought they were liberal judges. A judge is just going to insert their own opinion and make a decision overruling experts. That's an activist judge. Well, here we go. We have a Supreme Court, and it's an activist court because it's not just one judge. You have a majority of judges on the Supreme Court who are now activist judges. But, of course, when it's for an opinion that they like or for something that they want, you know, there's no problem being an activist. It seems like there was only a problem being an activist judge if you were liberal or you were fighting, in my opinion, on behalf of the people.
So there's a new ruling on homelessness. Can you go into that one?
So the decision that the Supreme Court issued on the homeless issue that really, you know, is a nationwide, countrywide issue is really detrimental. It's a type of ruling that put the police, once again, in a decision, in a capacity on the front lines, dealing with issues that go beyond anything that they're trained or even taught about during the course of the police academy or once they're a police officer. Why I say that is because the Supreme Court ruling essentially says a city, state, county can use policing as a way, in my opinion, to eliminate homelessness. Because what the Supreme Court has said, has ruled, is that a police officer on behalf of a city can see somebody sleeping in a public place, wake them up, and tell them, if you don't leave right now, you're going to get a ticket. And of course, if you don't take care of that ticket, that turns into a warrant. Or if you have too many tickets or outstanding warrants and I come up on you and you're sleeping somewhere, that turns into what? An arrest in jail. And, you know, if you go to jail enough times or you have too many outstanding warrants, that can also turn into what? Not jail, but prison. And so it's a very slippery slope, all because a person does not have a place to stay or sleep. Previously, what was going on was the ruling and the way that this had been enforced was to say, look, a police officer could only criminalize being homeless or being asleep in a public place if the city had other options for you. So if there's a homeless shelter you could go to and there's space available, then a police officer could tell you, hey, you got to go there. And if you don't go there, and if I catch you sleeping out here again, then I can give you a ticket. Now, there's no obligation for the city to provide any housing to people within its borders who are unhoused. So as opposed to there being like, hey, a requirement that a city provides some type of homeless housing option to people who are unhoused, they took that away. The Supreme Court said, no, that's not a requirement. You could just roll up on somebody, and if they're asleep, wherever in a public place, you could just tell them, look, you're getting a ticket. And if I see you here, you're getting another ticket. And the city can adopt a ruling saying, hey, just like cars in many places, if you get three tickets on your car, you know, we can impound it. Well, they're essentially saying, if you get three tickets on a human body, we could take you into custody, impound you into jail, and wherever else that goes. And so this is a very disturbing ruling because, as Judge Sotomayor said, sleeping is a prerequisite. It's a requirement for living. And so now what you've done is you've criminalized people simply for their status, simply because they don't have the financial means to afford housing, simply because they might have mental health issues, simply because maybe they prefer to sleep outside or to sleep in different areas that we might not want to sleep in as members of the Supreme Court, but this is what they prefer. And they've essentially criminalized the status of being unhoused here in America by telling cities that they can send out the police, not social workers, not housing advocates, not housing resources, not mental health advocates, but instead you send out people who are armed with guns and tasers and billy clubs and are given the authority by the state to use force if you don't comply with their orders.
Is this basically the black codes just being put on a class level? So everybody who's on the lowest class, which was mostly and still is mostly occupied by black people, but not just limited to black people in this case. What is the difference between the black codes of the past and what's being done now?
There isn't a distinction other than the one you made. The black codes were instituted once people were, quote unquote, liberated or freed from, you know, having to live and be enslaved on a plantation where people had no place to go. And so they turned trespassing and vagrancy laws into ways to criminalize being black because they had no property. They couldn't own property. They had no resources. They couldn't go rent anything. And so you had people who were no longer living on a plantation. And what the governments did, state by state, they criminalized the act of not having housing or being on public places. And that's what you're seeing now in 2024. So you drew an excellent connection to what had been in our past, which is why it's important to know your past, because then you can see where you're going in your future.
Can you also talk about a new ruling that the Supreme Court passed where they were talking about a president can't be charged for a crime for something that he has done while in service to the country? Or can you tell us what is that ruling about and why?
Yeah, sure.
And why is it concerning to some?
What the Supreme Court also ruled on, they essentially said that a president cannot face any type of criminal prosecution for things that they do while in office that can be interpreted as an official act. So, you know, one extreme example is the president is a commander in chief. As commander in chief, they're allowed to give orders to people, subordinates, which they have to follow or risk being court-martialed and themselves thrown in jail. If the commander in chief, the president, gives an order to kill someone, or to go and take somebody's property, and that was against the law, or they don't have the authority to do that because the law says that's not correct or that's unlawful, and a police order somebody to do that, and the president orders someone to do that, a president can never be prosecuted for that. So as long as a president, while they're in office, cloaks themselves with the explanation of, I did this, but this is an official act. This is a power that a president has, and in my discretion, I used it this way. You might interpret it as being a violation of the law. I disagree, but I can never even be prosecuted for it. There's not going to be a criminal investigation because I did that because that's an official act of me being a president. I have the right to make these decisions. You cannot object or come after me later as being a lawbreaker or like the president that we're talking about, President Trump, as being a convicted felon and then facing felony conviction or some type of criminal prosecution for it because I was president when I did it and I get to get away from it scot-free, even if it breaks the law. So this is a very troubling precedent that the Supreme Court has set because these are sort of the guidelines, the guardrails that is supposed to keep the most, what many term to be the most powerful person in the world, the United States president, who has the biggest military budget, and all these different resources is supposed to keep them personally in line so that they do not cross the line by abusing the power that they have. But the Supreme Court has essentially stripped that away. And now, in my opinion, a president could go rogue at any moment with the confidence of knowing that they'll never see a single day in court.
Well, let me ask you a question in reference to that. When we look back in the 90s, we saw that George Bush the first, we saw Dark Alliance, the book, come out, and it basically convicted the U.S. government in the court of public opinion of selling drugs in the United States, selling crack cocaine, starting in California, and funding the counter-revolution against the Salvadorian people and the Nicaraguan people. Nothing happened when that information came out. There were a number of town hall meetings all over the country. Some were headed by Maxine Waters in Los Angeles, even pulling out the CIA director, among other people. Then we can move on to his son, and they were looking for weapons of mass destruction. They stole the whole country. Iraq stole the resources from the country, killed millions of people, displaced millions of people, and nothing has happened. Obama overthrew Libya, killed the leader on television, and stole the resources, enslaved the people. Slavery may still be going on in Libya as it was going on after the assassination of Gaddafi. So, I mean, I know a lot of people talk about and look at this as something protecting Trump. But me, I like to look at it and ask two questions. One, why is this even being talked about? Because the United States president has never been convicted of the major crimes that they have committed, especially in the recent past. But two, is this to protect Trump or is this to protect Biden, who's involved in a genocide directly with Gaza and also involved in, say, the genocide in Congo and also the unrest that's involved in Haiti, but also Sudan? So, I mean, is it really protecting Trump and those convictions or is it protecting genocide Joe? Or I don't understand, even without the ruling, they've been protected. So please speak on those two things.
I think what you're pointing out, one is what the express law now says with the law of the land by way of the Supreme Court. And then you have the way in which laws are prosecuted or ignored based upon your status and what the government wants to get done. And so when you see, like, as you mentioned, which is a very detailed history about the two Bushes who were president, Obama and even Biden, you know, you see that it's easy to see that they violated a bunch of rules, a bunch of laws, and they never faced criminal prosecution. That's because the Department of Justice and the powers that be never had an appetite or interest in prosecuting those presidents for what they did, because what they did was seen as being in the public and the country's best interest in terms of maintaining its power over the world, right? World order.
Right.
What this issue was around Trump wasn't so much what he did to people in a foreign land. It's, can we come after you for perhaps an insurrection, perhaps for stealing an election, perhaps for committing fraud on the American people? So I think that the way in which this case was framed was looked at more domestically, whereas many of the things you're talking about have international implications, or they're doing it for some type of benefit for the American country, quote unquote, but they're terrorizing people in some other foreign land. Although we know with crack and everything else,
that's what I was gonna say.
Right here within our country.
I was gonna say I was gonna say COINTELPRO. We can take it to crack or COINTELPRO, and those were basically genocidal programs aimed at the black community within the United States, and nothing has happened.
Right. Well, you know, they say absolute power corrupts absolutely. And without checks and balances, which is what we're watching being dismantled, you know, right in front of our very eyes, the very small pieces that there were, you know, it's the greed, it's the ambitions of those in power to concentrate even more power in their hands. And that's what these decisions have done and will do, in my opinion.
Last but not least, let's talk about the bribery, legalized bribery. I mean, and just to preface this, there's a major controversy in the Supreme Court right now with Clarence Thomas, and he has a billionaire baby daddy or godfather that has been taking him around the country and around the world. But that was a controversy prior to this ruling. Now bribery has been legalized. Can you talk about the law, but also can you talk about the situation that was going on around the Supreme Court before they made this law, including this episode I'm talking about with Clarence Thomas?
Well, you know, the Supreme Court had for many, many, if you want to call it centuries, the masses of the people saw the Supreme Court as being neutral. They just interpret the law the way it's set forth, and they're there to you know, make sure that the executive branch, meaning the president and all of the people that work for them, and that the legislative branch, the people in Senate, Congress, mayors, so on and so forth, don't harm the democracy. However, for those who have been watching the court and understand the way the Supreme Court works and understand the way the judicial system works, it's always been political because many of these people are appointed by partisans, meaning people who are either Republican, Democrat, conservative, liberal, whatever term you want to use. The point is they are appointed to these positions by people who adhere to some certain ideology. And what you're seeing now is you have a Supreme Court that's packed, that has more people. They have a majority of people on the court adhere to a conservative ideology. Okay. And so what you're seeing happen is these rulings are coming down. Now, as it relates to Clarence Thomas, many people don't know. Clarence Thomas started his legal career on the other side of the political spectrum, working for the EEOC, Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. Once that went belly up and he had some life challenges, he then, as you see many people, and particularly minorities, people of color, black folks and others, they look at the long line to get to what they think is the top of professional or political or business success, being a liberal. Like, man, there's 1,500 black folks who are attorneys trying to get to the top of the Supreme Court. But how many are in line on the conservative line to get to the top of the Supreme Court? And he flip-flopped. He became conservative, started espousing that. Maybe he had been the whole time, but he had certainly been doing it in public. And then what do you know, he gets to the Supreme Court, and now he's buddy buddies with a billionaire buddy, and they fly all over the world. They send him on million-dollar vacations. They paid for his, I believe it's his nephew's tuition at a very private and affluent school. They paid off housing and things like that for him personally. And this is a person who has business in front of the court, who's had a lot of business in front of the court, because his billionaire buddy has an ideology that mirrors and much like the conservative plan. And now they're talking about, you know, the 2025 plan. So that's his buddy. And that buddy has business in front of the court. Don't you think that's influential? And none of this stuff was disclosed until recently, because the Supreme Court, surprise, surprise, does not have a code of ethics that's enforceable. It's just advisable.
Wow.
That'd be like us driving a car and they say 55 is the advised speed limit. Somebody could look at that and say, man, I want to go 200 miles an hour because my car lets me do it. A police couldn't do anything. They just have to watch the crash. They couldn't stop you.
Wow.
They couldn't give you a ticket. That's how the Supreme Court is set up. And so you put that into the context now of this bribery thing. So the case is this, and I'm going to try to simplify it. The Supreme Court has ruled that a person, a corporation or a politician or anybody in power could not be accused of taking bribes if the money, if the resource, if the assets, if the goods were given after the decision was made. So what the Supreme Court has said is like, look, if mayor of Walla Walla decides to award a contract, the water contract, to Company A, then the president or the CEO of Company A, after he gets the contract, decides to give the mayor $1 million, that couldn't be considered a bribe because it was given after the contract was awarded. So if CEO comes into the mayor, the president, the senator, the congressperson's office, the director of economic development, says, hey, I want to buy this land over here for $1. And then that's what happens. That decision is made. Sell the Coliseum, if we're talking about Oakland. Sell Staples Center, crypto.com. Sell the port of L.A. or the port of Long Beach to this developer for $2. And it's really worth $200 million. The developer gets it. If they then turn around after they're awarded the contract, after they're given the property, after the sale goes through, the deal goes through, and that CEO and that company then decides to send the mayor a Rolls Royce or send them on $1 million vacation or give them a jet or just deposit cash into their account, the Supreme Court said that's not a bribe. Why? Because it was done after the person got the contract.
Wow.
That's crazy.
Right.
That's crazy.
Most people are paid after they do their work.
Because they agreed to do the work.
Exactly. So, I mean, last question, because we're running out of time. How do these rulings make you feel about the Supreme Court of today?
It makes me feel that the Supreme Court of today is a reflection of the conservative, the MAGA, the those folks who are the 1% who are already cashing in and have cashed out. They're just saying, look, what does it matter? If we crush 99% of everybody and there's 0.1% left holding us back from being able to have total domination, why am I denying myself that? This is unbridled, unchecked ambition, power grab, consolidation of resources, a consolidation of power, and it's happening right in front of our eyes in real time. And most people are very concerned with just surviving day to day. Most people are consumed with entertainment and what's on TikTok and the new dance and all that kind of stuff. They don't see the very rights, the very thing. You can have all the critiques about our democracy and our country, but what your critiques are is about something that's at least being held back. What are your critiques going to be when there is no check or balance upon power being exercised against you as an individual, you as a group, and perhaps even you as an area, just in the country? If the people in power want to punish you, there's not going to be much to be done or anything that you can do to stand against it. And that's the scary thing. And that's what's happening now. Many of the things that have been protecting rights are being flipped, are being overturned, or they're being dismantled so that those in power can become what? Even more powerful and even more wealthy.
It's not nothing I can add to that. You were just listening to the voice of lawyer Adante Poynter for Lawyers for the People, as he described the ramifications of recent Supreme Court rulings that they just recently released in the last couple of weeks. Thank you, Adante, for being with us. This is the first, but not the last, man. We got to get you on very soon again.
Hey, brother, I enjoy your platform, man. Why? Because you understand how to connect history with the present in order to help us shape our future. Very few people do that with their platforms. Thank you, brother.
No doubt, man. Thank you for coming on. We'll talk soon.
That was Adante Poynter of Lawyers for the People, speaking to J.R. Valray of Block Report Radio. That was Archie Shepp, Blues for Brother George. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Polina Vasilyev. The recently completed Olympics was reported to be a financial success, but behind the Olympics was massive profiteering and ideological campaigns by the major Western imperialist countries. Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer interviewed athlete and professor George Wright about what happened and the future of the Olympics.
So, George, why don't you talk about this recent Olympics, what happened there and what was left out by the corporate media?
Okay. Well, there's a lot of ways of going about discussing this. And I think one of the key themes that's missed quite often is the structural nature of the Olympic movement. And that, in fact, what the Olympics are is a for-profit propelling industry or commodity for a lot of different interests. Now, what's kind of interesting is this is a relatively new phenomena related to the International Olympic Movement, because from its inception in the late 19th century, led by Baron Pierre de Coubertin, up until the 1970s, the Olympic movement was basically an elite bourgeois for a nonprofit effort to actually promote sport. But in the 1970s, the Olympic movement came to a halt because of the various structural crises of the 70s, the overall structural economic crisis, the rise of stagflation, and the so-called fiscal crisis of the cities, to where cities around the world could no longer afford to bid for the Olympic Games because of the various the deficit problems that they faced. So in 1978, when the bidding for the 1984 Olympics took place, the only city that put a bid out was Los Angeles. But that bid was specific in the sense that Los Angeles itself was also trapped in these fiscal problems as well. And so the organizers of the Los Angeles Games told the International Olympic Committee that they were going to pursue a privatized model to run the Olympics, rather than using solely public funds, which had been used over the years. It was now going to use private sources of money to fund the Olympics. And there were basically three areas of sources for money. One was to begin using corporate sponsorship, meaning to get monies from corporations and allow the corporations to use the Olympic logos and paraphernalia for its own purposes. The second was to use television money. Up until the 70s, the International Olympic Committee was not earning or making very much money. I think in 1972, they earned, I think, about $150,000 selling broadcast rights. But Los Angeles organizers began selling the broadcast rights to U.S. networks. And to make a long story short, as recently as 2011, NBC paid the International Olympic Committee $4.38 billion to broadcast three Olympic Games. In 2013, the NBC paid the International Olympic Committee $7.75 billion to broadcast the 2022 Winter Olympics, the Paris Olympic Games, the Los Angeles Olympic Games in 2028, and the Winter Olympic Games, I think, are going to be in 2026. So by the early 90s and certainly into the 2000s, the International Olympic Committee was earning upwards of $7 to $8 billion over a four-year cycle. So a tremendous amount of money was also being earned by the IOC.
Sports, it wasn't going to the athletes. In fact, I understand that American athletes, one of the things they were happy about is they got free health care in France.
Right, in the United States.
They don't have health care for any of the athletes.
But keep in mind what all of this is about. The games are being used as a marketing tool for NBC to profit from corporations that are buying commercial time, as well as advertising programs that are going to be on NBC, which will also have commercials that they can sell to advertisers as well. So it's a propelling industry is what it's about. Now, related to the athletes, there were several in track and field, which is the only sport I really watched because of my major interest in the sport. There were several athletes that were very prominent in the pre-Olympic advertising, during the Olympic competition, and immediately afterwards. And probably the most prominent one was the sprinter Noah Lyles from the United States, who won both the 100 meters and the 200 meters last year in the Budapest World Athletics Championships. Lyles was actually paid by NBC for this promotion. And in fact, there were two documentaries about Lyles on the Peacock Sports streaming service. And I've been told, I can't verify this, but I've been told that Lyles was given, paid, I think, about $1 million for these to make these documentaries. What was very important is using Lyles as an advertising tool to market the sport, it was expected that Lyles was going to win the 100 meters, the 200 meters, as well as run on both relay teams. Now, for anybody running, watching the Olympics, we see that Lyles won the 100 meters by only 0.005 of a second. But in the 200 meters, he ran in the 200 meters and got third, which obviously he wasn't supposed to do. But immediately after running the 200 meters, he collapsed, and it was acknowledged that he had COVID. And so what you can extract from that is that the teams around him, his supporters, his coaches, et cetera, his family members, as well as, I'm going to propose, NBC, even knowing that he had COVID, wanted him to run because of the marketing role that he played in all of this. Okay. Now, what has come out and what was kind of obvious as this was unfolding, running in this race with COVID, he was contagious and could have possibly infected his competitors. So that's, and I'm going to say a claim. One could argue that possibly could be considered a criminal act. But this is an extreme case of the marketing of the using athletes to market for corporate gain and all of this.
And this capitalism, which you say dominates the Olympics and the organization of the Olympics, profiteering, it was also, they excluded the Russian team from the Olympics, but apparently the Israelis who are committing genocide were not excluded.
Right, right.
Is that a double standard?
Well, you could consider it a double standard. Yeah, there's a little bit of hypocrisy there. In the broad sense of things, is there is a U.S.-inspired NATO war against Russia. And the battleground was, up until a week or so ago, just solely Ukraine. But now it seems to be reaching into Russia. Any escalation of this could lead to a global conflagration. Key contradiction from the inception of the International Olympic Movement back in the 1890s was that it claimed to be universal and non-political, and only individuals were going to participate in the games. But the structure of the Olympics has been national in a variety of different ways. And so there's a embedded contradiction when you have athletes representing nations, their flags are being presented at competitions, their national anthems are being played if they win the gold medal. They can only make the Olympic team based on national processes, et cetera. You have a real problem. Now, because of that, the Olympic Games have not only been integral to politics, they've been a magnet for politics. And so any particular issue, any particular historical moment, the geopolitical events, et cetera, are going to be reflected in the respective Olympic Games. Now, perhaps the most obvious and most blatant was the 1936 Nazi Olympic Games. But we've also seen the games being canceled during various wars. 1916 was canceled, 1940, 1944 was canceled. The pandemic saw the postponement of the Tokyo Olympic Games by 1 year. But also we've seen various demonstrations, political demonstrations at the games as well. And Tommy Smith and John Carlos, for example, raising their fists in an anti-racist demonstration was an example. The Black September wing of the PLO trying to kidnap Israeli athletes and coaches in 1972, leading to some 11 Israelis being killed in that episode, is another example. We've also seen a series of boycotts. 1976, Africans boycotted the Olympics. The U.S. boycotted the Moscow Olympic Games in 80 under the allegation that Soviet Union had invaded Afghanistan. The Soviet Union boycotted in 84 in L.A. So the Olympic Games cannot escape politics, whether it's domestic politics, whether it's geopolitical politics, or whether it's various groups, regardless of what political persuasion, try to use the Olympic Games to articulate their concerns. This is amplified by the fact that television now broadcasts the Olympics to where some 3 billion people or more are able to watch the games as well.
You say now, and I agree with you, that the Olympics is not only a nationalist operation and the way it operates, particularly with Western imperialism, Western countries, but also it is not a working class game, but it's orientated towards profiteering and towards using the athletes for corporate profits of the capitalist. What is the vision for a real Olympics that was not bound by profiteering and capitalism? How would that look like? And has that ever been tried?
Actually, it has been tried. In 1936 in Barcelona, there was a People's Olympic Games that was being presented and organized by communist parties around the world. But tragically, it was not able to implement itself. I mean, it literally, people were there in Barcelona, and the day it was supposed to start, or at least the day or two around the start, the Spanish Civil War started. And so these games never took place, okay? And so in some ways, it's a model that we look up to, but we have no idea how the model would have worked.
And another issue that has come up is the question of climate, the whole climate situation globally, increase in temperatures. They're saying now that they're not going to be able to have the Olympics in the future, in the summer, in countries like France, and the next one is in Los Angeles. And then you have a situation of snow melting around the world and not even having a winter Olympics. It's like capitalism is destroying the world. Let's have some more wars so we can increase.
The Beijing Winter Olympics a few years ago, they had to create fake snow to have the Winter Olympics, you know?
So the future of the Olympics is in question because of what capitalism is doing to the world and these wars, which are adding to the temperature rise. What do you see the future of this present Olympics? Because that one argument they were saying, or one suggestion, well, maybe they can have the Summer Olympics in the South.
Yes, right.
Winter.
Yeah, I'm going to promote some paper I wrote. I had an article published in Socialist Register back in 2015. Entitled The Olympic Ruling Class. And if you kind of weed through the paper, by the way, it was edited by Greg Albo and the great Leo Panitch. But if you kind of weed through my paper, my article, what you see is that the Olympic movement has been like an organism that has adapted to the context and the historical specificity that it's dealing with. And that it always comes up with some kind of managerial solution to the current problems. For example, this issue of why did Paris and Los Angeles get the Olympic Games? They got the Olympic Games because Hamburg, Rome, and Istanbul pulled out of the bidding process because they couldn't afford it. And then they had flipped the coin as to which was going to host it in 24, 28. Paris got 24, US, LA got 28. But that was unprecedented because the International Olympic Committee only in its history gave one city the Olympics 6 or 7 years down the line. They gave LA the Olympics because they were afraid when the actual bidding process for the 28 Olympics would come up, there'd be no cities that would be wealthy enough to bid for the Olympic Games.
That was Professor George Wright speaking to Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer. And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective, with contributions from J.R. Valray, Steve Zeltzer, and myself, Polina Vasilyev. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. And follow us on X, formerly Twitter, at PacificaCRD. I've been your host, Polina Vasilyev. Thanks for listening.